If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ruth's story resonates a lot with what's emerging in the Me Too movement, which started with these stories from Hollywood, where these very beautiful, very together, very well-presented women, actresses, were saying these horrible things that happened to them. And there was a lot of skepticism, I think, because of the fact that these were beautiful women who were solvent, who seemed very together. They didn't look like victims. I think the same is true of Ruth.
That was Gillian Pachter talking about Ruth Ellis, the last woman to be executed in Britain.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Tomorrow night, the 13th of March at 9 p.m, BBC 4 will be airing the first episode in a new series entitled The Ruth Ellis Files, exploring the story of one of the most famous and controversial cases in 20th century Britain. The series has been created by documentary maker Gillian Pachter, and she spoke to our website assistant Rachel Dinning.
So on this week's podcast, we're talking to filmmaker Gillian Pachter. For several months now, Gillian has been re-examining the case of Ruth Ellis, a mother of two who was hanged for the murder of her abusive boyfriend in 1955. It's a story that shocked the nation and had a dramatic impact on the death penalty debate in Britain. It's also the subject of Gillian's new three-part documentary airing on BBC 4 this week. So, Gillian, perhaps we could start by you giving us an overview of Ruth's crime and what took place on that fateful day in 1955 when she made this life-changing decision to shoot David Blakely.
Well, what we know as a fact is that at around 9:30 p.m. On the night of Easter Sunday, April 10th, 1955, David Blakely came out of the Magdala pub with a friend. Ruth shouted his name, and then she fired 6 bullets at him, and 4 of them hit their target, and he died at the scene. And she confessed her guilt and handed over the gun to an off-duty policeman who was there.
You just mentioned she confessed to this, and she confessed almost immediately. This would, to most people, make this case very clear-cut. It's murder. So why isn't this case straightforward?
Well, in a way, what's so interesting about it is that you start with something that looks pretty open and shut. I mean, a woman shoots a man at point-blank range in front of about 6 people. And certainly when I started looking at it, I thought, why is this case considered controversial? And the reason is that that is not necessarily murder, not the way the courts look at it now. It could be manslaughter, because of the defense of diminished responsibility. Now we have a system where we look at all of the circumstances that lead to somebody killing someone, and we take that into consideration when we're making a judgment as to whether or not that's called murder. Back at the time of Ruth Ellis, there wasn't that subtlety in the law. So really, actually, it was pretty open and shut to them at the time. But when you look at all of the paperwork and the evidence from a modern lens, you realize that it just falls apart as a case of premeditated cold-blooded murder. It really doesn't seem to have been that. And it's quite shocking to see the way it was investigated and tried at the time.
Right. So if we were looking at this case today, if this was something that happened last week, what sort of elements might make it a case for manslaughter rather than murder?
Well, I mean, I should say, first of all, you know, I'm not a legal expert myself, so I've just been consulting experts along the way, some really distinguished legal experts and detectives. And basically, what would potentially give her a verdict of manslaughter is the defense of diminished responsibility. So right now, anyone who defended her, a barrister who defended her, would be looking really hard at her psychological makeup, her what's called an abnormality of mind. So they would be, it's a very high bar, but they would be looking at, was Ruth really mentally well when she killed David? And they would be trying to unpick that. So what we know about Ruth, and you know, what I started discovering through the documents, through the evidence, is she had been routinely beaten by David Blakely, her victim. He had at points throttled her to the point that she thought that she was going to die. He had punched her so hard in the stomach that she had a miscarriage just a couple weeks before the murder. So those kinds of things in the modern era, you piece those things together and they may amount to somebody being so not in their right mind, what's called an abnormality of mind, that you really can't convict them of murder. You can only really convict them of a lesser charge of manslaughter. And, you know, quite often that kind of defense is invoked for women who have suffered a sustained period of abuse at the hands of their victim.
Did corruption or negligence play a part in the outcome of a case, or was it a product of its time?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting question. I mean, and that those were the questions that led me through the case. I would say the answer is both. So I think we really can't dispute the fact that when the judge ruled that she really didn't have a defense, that the defense of provocation, which was the only one that was open to, the only defense that was open to her at the time, didn't run in Ruth's case. He was right. He would have had to have wanted to make a new law to really update the law to accommodate Ruth to give her an actual defense. Now, that said, throughout the investigation into her crime, absolutely things were overlooked, under-investigated, and conclusions were reached which were just inaccurate. One of the main results of that was that the other person who was involved in her crime, in the murder, Desmond Cusson, who was her sort of sugar daddy, her other lover, got away with his role in it. And part of what I was doing was looking at his statements, looking at what the police knew about him, looking at the evidence that I found via Ruth's own son's testimony, and also just the gaps in the investigation and inconsistencies. And along with expert help from detectives, it seemed pretty conclusive, although it's never been proven in court, that Desmond Cusson did have a role. And it was something that he was never arrested for, and went to his grave without formally, without acknowledging and without ever being charged at all. So, you know, and I think with Ruth, on a subtle level, you know, had the investigation into her crime been less prejudiced, I think the jury might have been moved to mercy. I think it's possible that could have filtered down to a reprieve. But she was investigated very much through the veil of class prejudice. She was a working class girl. She'd killed her upper middle class boyfriend basically because he represented a leg up and he was getting away from her, and she took revenge, which is totally reductive and completely inadequate understanding of her motive.
It's interesting that the class element came into it. One of the other things was the fact that she was a victim of domestic abuse. Do you think if this had been taken into consideration, it would have made a difference? How were cases of domestic abuse treated at this time? I think you talked to a few police officers about this in the first episode.
I did. I mean, it's really extraordinary and shocking that back then, and speaking to these officers through really the 80s, there's a little acronym which meant no cause for police action. You'd be called out to a domestic, and that was just husbands and wives. But it didn't result in any kind of arrest or criminal process. So at this point in history, domestic violence is just a private affair. And I think even though people knew about what had happened to Ruth, she told her lawyer, there's plenty of documentation about it. You know, it was not disputed. It simply wasn't considered relevant in terms of her motive or anything that might mitigate her crime, which is absolutely not the case today.
You mentioned this fellow called Desmond Cusson. What was Cusson's involvement with the murder, as you understand it?
Well, my understanding, which partly comes from what I found out from Ruth's family and the tape that her son Andre made before taking his own life, is that he provided Ruth with a murder weapon, that he took her for target practice, that he was with her and drove her around on the day of the murder. And then there are slightly different formulations that emerge, different kinds of details, like Andre remembering him saying, I have a gun, it's old and rusty, shall I oil it? That, you know, without him having been charged, it's hard to know exactly what that adds up to. Does that make him an accessory, an accomplice, a joint principal? Those are the kinds of things that you only know when you actually investigate someone properly. And he was not investigated. He was really treated as a witness, but not a suspect. So there's an issue there, which is, how would that have impacted Ruth's verdict? That's quite hard to know, whether the jury would have felt more sympathetic or felt that she was coerced in some way. But there's a separate issue, which is whether or not it impacted Ruth's verdict. If there's somebody out there who has been involved in a crime, there should be a separate process to deal with that. So he might have had his own trial. Who knows what the result would have been. But the question isn't only, how would it have impacted Ruth? You know, there's an issue there about someone getting away with his role in a murder.
I was wondering, could you tell us what you know about Ruth's backstory and her, you know, a bit of her life history?
Yeah, well, she was born in rural North Wales, and her father was a musician, played in cinemas, you know, silent movies. And it was not a happy household. Her father was sexually abusive toward her and her sister. They also fell into poverty. And so at around the age of 16, 17, Ruth is going out and working. She works in the OXO factory. You know, a lot of young women are working. It's during the war, and then we're not in work after that. But she also she wasn't the kind of girl who was going to be happy with an ordinary job. So she was drawn to Soho. She met this handsome Canadian, got pregnant. The soldier, he turned out to already be married. So then she was a single mother by the age of about 17. That was Andre, the boy who was living, who was 10 when she committed the murder. And then as a single mother, she's still ambitious and singing in clubs. She gets bit parts and she gets a bit part in a Diana Doors movie. And she starts rising the ranks of the drinking clubs, which are this, this quite special post-war environment where they have more liberal hours than the pubs. And you get this kind of clandestine mixing of classes, and you get these working class girls, and you get judges and upper class men and cops and businessmen. You get a whole mix of men who are going through those doors. And so she made her living in that world.
And what were the origins of her relationship with Blakely?
So Blakely met her at the Little Club, which was the last drinking club where she worked, and so did Desmond Cusson. So this love triangle, which really defined the last 2 years of her life and led to the murder, was really born out of this club environment. So you know, both of these men, David and Desmond, were upper middle class, quite wealthy, and that kind of toxic love triangle emerged in that environment. And then she and David developed a very, very intense, violent love and hate relationship. Certainly Ruth seems to have been obsessed by him. And I think he certainly, I don't know if he had the same level of feeling, but he seems not to have been able to really pull away from her. And certainly they're in and out of each other's lives just constantly, and it's very explosive and dysfunctional and violent.
Many of the detectives at the time seemed quite interested in this idea that Ruth was perhaps a bit of a social climber, and this could possibly have been a factor in the murder. I mean, is there any truth in this?
Well, I think one of the things that's tragic about Ruth is that she had really done very well. She'd come from a very dysfunctional family and a poor background. She was ambitious. You know, she was drawn into the bright lights of Soho, and she ended up managing, you know, a club that had a lot of well-to-do people going through it. And she was the manageress. She earned a really good wage. You know, I think she was earning about £5 a week. She was doing really well. I think what's tragic about Ruth is that because she mixed with these men, you know, of upper classes, she, I think, felt that maybe that world was open to her, that she was really their friend. And also she thought that maybe she would actually marry David. And the reality is they were only mixing with her in hours of darkness. You know, as soon as the sun came up, David never introduced her to his mother. You know, he never proposed to Ruth. He was engaged to other more appropriate girls. And so she was this, you know, she was a woman that people were embarrassed about. And so I think that Ruth was confused. I think so much of her social life, you know, indicated to her that she was really freely mixing and that her class was no barrier. And yet at the end of the day, it really defined everything for her. And once you see the evidence of her being processed through the system and also the press at the time, I mean, it's just so reductive, you know, the heavy makeup, the brassy blonde, it's all this code for, you know, she's cheap.
That's a good point. How is she portrayed in the media at the time?
It's really funny about Ruth because she played the part. So she's basically written about as though she's a femme fatale from a film noir. You know, she the press were very excited about this bleach blonde and her stilettos and her, you know, her immaculate getup and her heavy makeup. She was like, she looked like a gangster's mole or, you know, some sort of titillating bad girl from a movie. You know, kind of an amalgam of things. She looked a little bit like a 30s silent film star. She looked a little bit like Marilyn Monroe or Diana Dors, you know, and she also looked like, you know, one of these darker femme fatale characters. So reading about her, it's like you're just in the middle of a Raymond Chandler novel. It doesn't feel like anyone's writing about a real person. On the other hand, Ruth created that effect consciously. She dressed like that. She was very glamorous, and she showed up in court looking like she was, you know, about to enter, you know, looking like she was entering a nightclub. She'd had her hair freshly bleached. So she was reinforcing that idea of herself. And I think, you know, when I listen to her voice, which is this very theatrical accent, you have to accept that Ruth presented herself as this femme fatale type figure, or this brassy blonde. You know, it wasn't just something, it wasn't just a judgment that the newspapers were making about her.
What was the public's reaction to her? How was she seen in their eyes?
What's really poignant, what I discovered, and, you know, what I touch on a bit in episode 3, which is the period around the execution, is that actually just hundreds of people wrote to the Home Office begging to reprieve Ruth Ellis. And when they write about her, it's just very modern. You think these people have a modern mindset. They don't judge her for being single, for being working class. They're sympathetic. They're concerned that that she miscarried close to the event. You know, they're concerned about the violence that she suffered. You know, it's the kind of language which wouldn't be out of place now. And it was really amazing to see that, you know, having looked at how the authorities treated Ruth, when I finally came to evidence from what the public thought, they seemed to be just way ahead of the authorities.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Do you think that her case was fundamental in turning around British laws about the death sentence?
If people know anything about Ruth Ellis, they know that she was the last woman to be hanged. What fewer people know is that the defense of diminished responsibility came onto the books 2 years after her death. And that's a defense which is still in our courts, you know, and it is the defense which could change murder to manslaughter and which is available to someone like Ruth, who is just not in her right mind because of, in her case, sustained abuse. So I think that in a way, the greatest impact that Ruth had was that the idea that you can't just dismiss this kind of a case as coldly premeditated murder. When you look at the circumstances, it becomes something else. And you understand that she's not just this cold-blooded femme fatale. She is this woman who suffered a great deal. And that adds up to something called diminished responsibility. And really, had she been tried 2 years later, she might have had a different verdict, which is very sad. That same kind of movement that brought about diminished responsibility is connected to the movement to end capital punishment, which also was gaining momentum at this time. And 10 years after her death, capital punishment was abolished. She was the last woman to hang. In 1965, capital punishment was outlawed in Great Britain.
What was the public's reception to the outcome of Ruth's trial? Did the case impact on people's beliefs about the death penalty?
Well, I think it was a perfect storm. I mean, I think that somehow along the way, the people who were involved and also the people that were sort of spectators to it, the public, just got a kind of bad feeling. Like it's akin to when you feel you find yourself carried along by something. There's a little voice in you that knows what you're doing isn't quite right, and it's only after it's all over that you think, have I done something terrible? Have I been part of something wrong? And you just feel that with all of the actors in the case. You know, people were incredibly touched by it. You know, the barristers, the judge, you know, people were still talking about it. And it impacted people so greatly. I mean, her solicitor, arguably he just didn't recover from it. He was ill. He suffered from alcoholism. He was still felt very guilty 20 years later. It was this kind of moral burden that people carried around, which I found extraordinary, that somehow it had seeped into the sort of conscience of, you could even say, a nation, and really fundamentally altered it.
I mean, it's interesting because women were rarely executed in Britain. We have a statistic that we recently put in one of our magazine articles, something like 90% of women who are sentenced to death were reprieved. So what do you think it was about Ruth's case that resulted in a death sentence?
Well, that's such an interesting question. I mean, I think when you look at the trial, her solicitor, who, of course, can't represent her in court, that has to be a barrister, but prepares her case. Her solicitor really wanted to get her background across. He'd gotten so much of the truth about Ruth's background, which the police never had, and he'd prepared this whole defense. And in court, you know, what actually came out was really not that at all. Her barrister really didn't understand women, really couldn't draw Ruth out, expressed surprise at the way she was describing abortion or losing a baby. You have this feeling of a courtroom that's just diminishing her humanity. So what her solicitor was hoping is that the jury would at least recommend mercy. You know, it was a long shot in terms of the law that she'd actually be acquitted or get manslaughter, but he was hoping they'd recommend mercy, and they didn't. They went out for 14 minutes and made no recommendation for mercy because the real Ruth hadn't come out. I think one of the answers to the question, why wasn't she reprieved when almost all women were, who were condemned, is maybe it had to do with the kind of woman she was. I mean, on one level, it was because there was a view that this was a coldly premeditated murder, so why would you reprieve her? On the other side of that, you know, there had been such a campaign for reprieve, not just by her own lawyers, but the public, newspapers, foreign governments, and all this stuff about her background had emerged that was sympathetic. And elements of whether she had an accomplice, which threw doubt on the whole story of the murder, all of this stuff had emerged. And one of the things you have to conclude, I think, or that I've concluded, is that she was just the wrong kind of woman. You know, this was a time when women were supposed to go back into their houses, you know, hearth and home, get married, make babies. And all of these women who'd had freedom during the war because they'd been working, the forces of society were saying, let's just get back to the old ways. You know, men can assume their proper place in society. Women get back in the kitchen. And I'm sure many women embrace that. That wasn't for Ruth. She stood for everything but that. She was a single mother. She was working. She was sexually active. She was glamorous. I mean, she couldn't be farther from, you know, the sort of domestic goddess type, you know, figure. So was she to have reprieved her? Maybe that would have been seen as an endorsement of the wrong kind of woman. You know, so I think the decision not to reprieve her wasn't just about the specifics of her case. It was about who Ruth was and what she represented as a woman.
How should we remember Ruth today?
Well, you know, I think it's really interesting. It resonates, Ruth's story resonates a lot with what's emerging in the Me Too movement, which started with these stories from Hollywood, where these very beautiful, very together, very well-presented women, actresses, were saying these horrible things that happened to them. And there was a lot of skepticism, I think, because of the fact that these were beautiful women who were solvent, who seemed very together. They didn't look like victims. I think the same is true of Ruth. You know, I think people looked at her at the time and they thought, well, she just looks like a sort of, you know, cold, cool, calm, collected gangster's mole. She doesn't look like a victim. She doesn't look like a woman who's suffering, you know, and look at her. She's so dressed up. She's asking for it. And of course, that's foolish. And I would hope now, but, you know, it's a lesson we're still learning that, you know, somebody like Ruth, you really have to look beyond the makeup and the high heels and the immaculate dress sense, because none of that indicates what's actually going on. It may even be a defense mechanism for what's actually a really distressing, you know, hiding a lot of pain and a really distressing life. So, you know, I would hope we'd see through the heavy makeup these days, but it's certainly a struggle that continues.
Definitely. That's a really interesting parallel. Do you think Ruth is a victim? Would you see her as a victim of, you know, a cruel boyfriend who abused her, and even a legal system that may have been prejudiced against women?
Well, you know, I think what's really interesting is I was guided a lot by Andre's insights. And one of the things that initially struck me was he was saying to Christmas Humphreys, the prosecutor, you called my mother cold-blooded. I believe this to be an untruth. And it got me thinking about the whole idea of being cold-blooded. And I think, you know, which is this expression that still hangs around today. And I think the reality is that when you really look at the circumstances that lead to somebody killing somebody else, you know, most people aren't born that way. And if you really, really look at them and their lives, you will see a whole lot of damage that has led to them inflicting damage on somebody else. And so I think Ruth is a victim on that level, but I think there are many people who are thought of now as cold-blooded killers because we have our own prejudices about race, about whether someone's from the countryside or a city, about all sorts of things, where certain people we attribute the idea of being cold-blooded to, and see their murders as straightforward. And really, most of those people in their lives, like Ruth, have been victims.
I think I know what your answer to this question is going to be. Was justice served on the day that Ruth Ellis was hanged?
I'd say broadly, no. And the reason it wasn't served isn't because they didn't get the person who pulled the trigger. The reason justice wasn't served is because the law was wrong. And we know that now. And Ruth should not have been handled the way that she was. Capital punishment should not have existed. And the defense of diminished responsibility, which we now recognize as a legitimate defense, should have been available to her. So I'd have to look at her and say she didn't get justice. However, we have to take account of, strictly speaking, according to the law at the time, the verdict was a just verdict. But that doesn't mean that we don't have to regard ancient justice as just. And in this case, it isn't.
So I think that's just about everything we've got time for today. Thanks for talking to us, Gillian. For our listeners interested in learning more, Gillian's three-part documentary series, The Ruth Ellis Files, starts on BBC Four on Tuesday the 13th of March.
So that was Gillian Pachter. And if you'd like to read more about Ruth Ellis, then you might be interested in an article we published about the case in our February edition, which is available as a back issue and in digital. OK, well, that's about it for today, but please do join us again on Thursday when we'll be examining the story of the Marshall Plan.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.